From the studios of KXAM, welcome to Tell the Truth Faster, hosted by Stuart Altshuler, marriage and family therapist. Stay tuned and learn how you can open your mind and soul to new possibilities in life. Now here's your host, Stuart Altshuler.
Welcome to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler. I'm a licensed marriage and family therapist, and this is a show where every week we deal with a variety of mental health issues from a holistic perspective, which basically means the importance of achieving a consciousness of balance in body, mind, and spirit in the process called psychotherapy, or even just in our own interpersonal growth work. And we all know that the truth will set you free. The question I ask on this program is, how long are you willing to keep freedom on hold? Now, a number of times over the last 3 years, and actually I'm amazed because when I was talking with today's guest, who I'll introduce in a moment, I realized that I've been on the air now for nearly 3 years. And, well, actually this month is 3 years. And over the course of these 3 years, I've done a variety of shows, some dealing with very personal issues, some more clinical issues like depression, things like that, and the focus was a bit more clinical. But everything that I deal with has to do with the impact of our external world on our internal world, and how our internal world impacts our external world. And sometimes that's done very consciously, sometimes that interaction is a very subconscious process. Now, the concept of how current events affects our lives, how things that happen around us, my prayers have been going out to friends and total strangers who have been in the path of the hurricane in Florida. In fact, luckily I got emails from my two friends in the Tampa area, and they both weathered it really well. So when we're dealing with externals, we know that something like natural causes like hurricanes, tornadoes, droughts, things like that, always have an impact on us that instill fear, instill depression. We're dealing with loss, like the show I did a few months ago when the fires were raging out here in California, and people were losing their homes and having to say goodbye to what was familiar and what was their comfort level. The emotional impact everything that's happening around us has. Now, with that being said, I also want to take a moment before actually getting into the topic, because I believe this is relevant. Today's show I'm actually dedicating to the memory of a woman that I have always found very courageous and very compassionate. Her name is Barbara Cleaver Tilsner. Barbara died on August 2nd at age 66. And I knew Barbara. She joined me back in the early 90s. I founded a nonprofit organization called the International AIDS Project. And our focus was to try and do some efforts to train and prevent the impact of the HIV and AIDS epidemic on Russia and the former Soviet Union. Back in the early 90s, there were very few cases there that they knew of, and we were already immersed in death and destruction here and in many other Western countries, not to mention Africa and a lot of third world countries. And Barbara was the co-founder of an organization called Mothers of AIDS Patients, the Los Angeles chapter. And in 1991, she helped me bring some compassion and understanding to a nation like the former Soviet Union that was just filled with such fear and turmoil. And what she brought was a mother's love. She helped found the Los Angeles chapter of Mothers of AIDS Patients when, in 1984, her son, Scott Cleaver, who was 26 years old, died from HIV and AIDS. And at the time, she knew she was alone in this. There were not a lot of other mothers or fathers talking to one another, and that was the support she needed. And so she piggybacked on a group, I think, in San Diego, and founded the group here in Los Angeles. And I learned about Barbara's death by reading the obituaries a couple of days ago. And ironically, she was a lifelong non-smoker and passed away of lung cancer. So today's show is dedicated to her memory and her activism and her passion and an example of exactly part of what we'll be talking about today is taking her inner grief and putting it actively into the world. Some people take their inner emotions and their inner belief systems and convert them into a healing process, a process that is meant to actually bring people together. Some people take their inner beliefs and their inner act and their inner pains and suffering and religious teachings and turn it into a form of fanaticism that causes death and destruction and fear and horror and ends up leaving all of us living in this constant state of fear, just like with the Olympics starting. It's an amazing event, but everybody there has a certain level of fear and trepidation of what could happen, what might happen, who's out there trying to make something happen to spoil what is supposed to bring nations together beyond politics, beyond religion, beyond social aspects of who people are. And that's the essence of today's show. The title is How to Think in an Age of Fanaticism. And in my weekly announcement, I describe fanaticism as characterized by an outlook or behaviors marked by intense and uncritical devotion, such as zealous and unthoughtful approach to one's political, religious, or social beliefs is one ingredient that foments the hatred and violence we see in terrorist acts. And that is actually a quote from my friend and colleague who I am introducing to you now. Her name is Constance Kaplan. She's a marriage and family therapist in the Los Angeles area, and she specializes in working with unique issues of creative artists and their families. She was founding president of the Association of Psychoanalytical Thought of Southern California, and she has a private practice in West Los Angeles. Constance, welcome to the show for the second time.
Thank you, Stuart.
And is there anything you'd like to add to that intro that you want people to know about you before we get into the meat of this topic that you yourself proposed that we talk about today?
No, actually, I thought you did a terrific introduction, and the only thing I want to say is that your friend Barbara is the kind of role model that we really want to keep in mind as we listen to today's show.
And why do you say that? What's the essence of today's show?
Well, you know, in a nation that tends to idealize the us while condemning the them, it's a very disconcerting notion to suggest that some of the psychological ingredients that compel terrorists to commit hateful acts of violence is increasingly shared by parts of the electorate that are engaged in their own jihad, which is a holy war against good and evil.
Yeah. I mean, I call it our domestic Cold War.
Yes.
You know, it's kind of like this unspoken, but we know there are so many people out there thinking of it in terms of, you know, them versus us.
Exactly.
That attitude, the same thing we had with the international Cold War.
Yes, and your friend Barbara found the one in many and the many in one. She bridged her life with those of people that she cared about. She extended the limits of what was of interest to her, and she applied it to other people who were unlike her, right?
Mm-hmm.
So she had connections. She was all about forging links and forging connections instead of being divisive and having an us-them mentality. But when you look at, in counterpoint to your friend, when organized parts of our citizenry zealously and with a rabid kind of rhetoric foment an us versus them mentality, which you know, dividing our nation into religious, cultural, and political polarities, such as the faithful versus the godless, the patriot versus the coward, straight families versus gay families, and so on, you have some of the makings of a jihad. And I want to be clear, I'm not talking about good, thoughtful people with strong and passionate convictions, because one can be devoted to one's convictions and still leave room for healthy reflection and even doubt, right? I think that's the sign of a mature mind. But as a
and a respect that other people may have opinions different from yours.
Yes. And what creates a dialogue is that you try to find not just the differences, but you try to find the commonalities.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, but as a psychotherapist, what intrigues me in my office every day, and what I address every day, and I'm addressing now, is the kind of closed, uncritical, inflexible, and unreflective mindset that generate extreme feelings and thoughts that can lead to destructive behaviors.
Now, I want to make it clear, and I believe from my discussions with you, you agree with this, that we're not just talking about the fanaticism that some of us may think of the, say, religious right in this country. We're also talking about the fanaticism that could take place on the far left in this country, too.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that, you know, even you and I are sitting here saying, you know, this is about judgment of that far right type of fanaticism, which is talked about a lot more. But there are also extremists and fanatics on both ends of the spectrum.
Anytime you find uncritical devotion to a cause or a belief, and uncritical is the word we want to keep in mind, because it suggests that we're not really parsing out, we're not really finding, you know, you should excuse the expression these days, nuances. We have a black and white mentality that doesn't allow us to forge connections and build bridges and come to some kind of middle ground, the kind of dichotomous thinking that goes on in any kind of fanatical mind. Alienates people and creates divisions and foments rage rather than understanding. And from a psychological perspective, this kind of thinking, which is actually an oxymoron because it really represents a lack of thinking, at its very best it's an immature kind of mind, is very worrying because it's a mindset that forfeits complexity. It relies on cliches, ignorance, assumptions, and rejects any new information to the contrary because it may muddy up the works. It relies on a rigid adherence only to the tenets of one's own limited group. And then in order to rationalize that position and, you know, to hold a higher moral ground, whatever it may be, it must demean and find dangerous that which is different. And I don't care if you're on the extreme left or the extreme right, this is the stuff that bigotry and prejudice are made of.
Well, let's talk about bigotry and prejudice for a minute, because, you know, the foundation of a lot of that is fear and hatred. And how do you define hatred in this context?
Well, hatred is a very important myth that ups the ante with fanaticism and can turn it into a jihad terrorist kind of mind. Hatred is, you know, in common usage, we define it as a strong dislike of someone or something. But in psychological terms, it's much darker and more pathological. It requires an obsessive, consuming, tethered attachment to another or others in a way that's very destructive, actually, to both the hater and the hated. So that's a very important thing to keep in mind as we think about this election and the kind of obsessiveness that we have toward particular groups, okay? The question is, how does it get formed? Because you got to know how it gets formed so you know how to prevent its formation. And how does it get manipulated into an organized group mindset? It's one thing if you have people who have individual mindsets like this, where it gets dangerous. And certainly, I believe we're seeing this in the country, and I think we're seeing it very much on the right, is how this is getting organized. All of us as human beings, and this is what we do for a living, you and I, are challenged with internal conflicts, right? Feelings,
right.
Helplessness, deprivation, disappointment, failure, loss, inadequacy, humiliation. It's being human. And such internal struggles today are especially intensified in a world that is so uncertain and so incredibly competitive and with increasingly fewer resources. Let's talk about the difference between, in the formation of hate, the capacity to think, and then the lack of capacity that contributes to fanatical hatred.
And before we do that, I want to remind our listeners that this is a live call-in show, and I'm sure a lot of what Constance and I are talking about are triggering reactions and thoughts. If you feel like calling in and asking a question or contributing to the conversation briefly, the number in Phoenix is 480-949-1310, 480-949-1310. If you're listening via the Internet, as I know a number of you are out there, it is the same number, and it's a toll call for you, but, you know, not all that expensive with today's rate, so call in 480-949-1310. So continue where you were in terms of those differences.
Okay, let's contrast the two, the capacity to think and then the difference with fanatical thinking. Given that we have all, and you set it up beautifully in at the top of the show, the capacity to think, okay, to use our what I call psychic muscles, powerfully affects how we respond to our internal life. And how we respond to our internal life powerfully shapes how we perceive our environment. As you said very poignantly, there are external events. There is poverty. There is a danger to one's, an immediate danger to, one, you know, to one's bodily safety. We need to have a roof over our head. But as human beings, we are the least tethered to our instincts of any beings on Earth. The rest of it is what we do internally and how we come to view what's going on, right? That's
what
we're
saying. By being least tethered to our instincts, you're saying we're creatures who have a mind that can reason or react without reason within our thinking.
Precisely. And those of us who work at being thoughtful, critical thinkers reflect on painful thoughts and feelings rather than act them out. We struggle to endure our frustrations, to put them into some sort of perspective, to reconcile internal contradictions, of which there are so many. And we know that thoughts and feelings and beliefs are not necessarily facts. And this allows us to take responsibility for our dilemmas, which is ultimately both empowering and humbling. Right?
Right.
That, if you want to talk about the ultimate spiritual path, it's struggling with this kind of process every single day. But the fanatical thinker shuts down this process. The fanatical thinker who becomes a hater doesn't develop the mature psychic muscles that allows him or her to endure such dilemmas, including, by the way, guilt for one's own unhappiness. Instead, these conflicts and these agonies and these frustrations get externalized. They're gotten rid of. And that necessitates, and here we go with this election, a place to put them. So the person or group who becomes the recipient of our own, shall we say, undigested issues, is the one we fanatically hate. And here's how it works. Sometimes we despise the other, right?
Mm-hmm.
Remember, this is the healthy thinker builds bridges, the fanatical thinker severs them.
Right.
It's the us-them mentality.
Mm-hmm.
Black and white, no grays. We despise them because they represent what we can't tolerate in ourselves, or we come to believe that they are responsible for our feelings and our deprivation and our misery. We may even, and this is the definition of envy, we may even enviously believe that they took something from us, which has resulted in our diminished resources, even though in reality, they play no part in our deprivations, right?
Right.
If the deprivations are internal and I feel that I can't really control it, I have to look outside and find something that I can control. And then to justify our beliefs and actions, we have to distort what we see and we think. So then what happens is a daily unmetabolized internal struggle with all of this stuff of being human, if you don't have the psychic musculature, which is tough work, isn't it, can get concretized in a crusade against good and evil. It gets externalized. Instead of saying, you know, with our patients all the time, Stuart, we're always saying, you know, We have to find the middle ground here. Anytime we have extremist kinds of thinking, our patients who come in with extremist kinds of thinking are those who are, by definition, and they come to therapy because not that they want to spend money, they come because they're unhappy.
Right.
They come because extremist kinds of thinking alienates them from their key relationships, their children, their partners, their colleagues, and if there isn't a kind of flexibility of thought to allow them to come to some kind of third way of thinking, which is it's not either or, us, them. There's something in the middle, and I have a role in it, and I have a part of it, which, as I said earlier, is both empowering and humbling. Right?
Right.
Okay. So if we take hatred, and this is where, this is the meat of something that I, you know, if we take hatred and we play it out in the cultural, political, and religious divide, where is it most egregiously at work? Would that be a fair question for the show?
It's a very fair question. And we're going to take a short break here because I want to keep the thoughts flowing. So this, with that question, is a good time to take a short break here and give people a chance to think and call in. So this is Stuart Altshuler on KXAM. You're listening to Tell the Truth Faster with my guest, Constance Kaplan. And we'll be back in just a few minutes, so stay tuned. Welcome back to Tell the Truth Faster. This is Stuart Altshuler, and we are discussing today how to think in an age of fanaticism with my guest, the marriage and family therapist from Los Angeles, Constance Kaplan, who's been on the show before. And before the break, we were talking about, you had asked the question, how do you see fanatical hatred playing out in the cultural, political, and religious divide? So, you know, during the break, Constance, we were talking again about my friend Barbara. Well, to me then, I knew her as Barbara Cleaver. Her husband had passed away over the last years, and she remarried her second husband, so she became Barbara Cleaver Tilsner. And we were talking about hatred, things like that, and the fact that her son died in 1984. And we're talking about a time when HIV and AIDS was still this, you know, something everybody lived in terror and judgment on. Anybody that was dealing with AIDS or had AIDS or was gay or anything like that were, to the mainstream America, to our federal government and many local governments, these people were to be hated and pariahs. And here this middle America mother was faced with dealing with something that she had no one to turn to. There were no peers, no other moms, and that's why it motivated her to do something positive with what was going on and to fight the judgment and to overcome the fear that others were feeling and actually speak out and make a difference. And this is part of what we're talking about today, isn't it?
Well, absolutely, Stuart, because what is eloquent about what this woman did in contrast to what is so ugly about what's happening and, you know, as we talk about how it's playing out, I would like to talk about the assault, an organized assault on the gay family, is that when a mother like this speaks, we're no longer talking about categories. We're no longer talking about us versus them. We're talking about the collective we. You know, a mother with children, we all know what it could be like to have a child who is ill. We all know what it's like to have a child who could be different. And this is where we forge connections in life, and this is where we bridge these kinds of false dichotomies and false categories into something that is ultimately human and inclusive. You know, the cynical manipulation of the issue about the gay family, and it's the wedge issue, I think, speaks to the vulnerability of this target group. I mean, I have never seen anything like this as a marriage family therapist. You know, I want to stand up and cheer every time I have a person who says, I want to assume the rights and responsibilities of devotion and marriage and commitment and fidelity and struggle with living my life out in a loving way with another person. So, I mean, how on earth could a gay couple, you know, who commits to such rights and responsibilities in any way endanger anyone's marriage? But based on what I've said so far, I have a theory that I want to throw out there and play with about, you know, in a serious way, about some of what may be fueling such a rabid assault on gay families and the fear that their desire to marry actually threatens heterosexual families.
What's that theory?
Well, you know, let's look at the obvious, because you kind of got to get the obvious out of the way, because that's, you know, and they're well warned. Okay, consciously, you're going to have a lot of people who cite strict adherence to the Bible. Of course, a developed mind points out that it's only conveniently and selectively strict, because the Bible also advocates a lot of things we do not do, including slavery and stoning adulterers. And, well, again, if you look at the kind of mindset I'm talking about, that gets compartmentalized out of the issue to justify a point of view, because if you then, if you struggle with the contradictions, that's where you get mature thinking, right? The notion that it opens the doors to marrying your cat, okay, that's the incendiary one.
Right.
It'll open the doors to bestiality, which is really demeaning, or your brother, is what I call a bogus categorical confusion, but you and I can get into that later, or, you know, on another show.
Right.
Okay. But it's an unconscious threat that many heterosexual families feel towards gay marriage that intrigues me, and I think it goes something like this. To quote a certain demonized Democratic president, it's the economy, stupid. The headlines earlier this week reported abysmal job growth. There were 32,000 jobs created in July as opposed to 200,000 predicted, right? I mean, wasn't that the big headline?
Right.
Okay. You look at technology allowing companies to produce more goods without adding workers. Many jobs are moving to lower-wage countries. And I believe this is accurate, that there are a million fewer jobs today than there were when President Bush took office. I think the last time that happened was in 1932, when we were mired in a depression. This is not a fact you want to go into your reelection with.
Right.
Last week's New York Times had an article about personal bankruptcy, that it's at an all-time high for white middle-aged Americans who've gone from relative comfort to going broke. And it's due to an unstable job market, inability to pay debts, increased housing costs, medical care. The article said more people, this blew me away, will end up bankrupt than will suffer a heart attack, die of cancer, or graduate from college. Now, what you create here are unstable and insecure social conditions that produce or can produce an unbearable assault on one's internal sense of adequacy, identity, feelings of deprivation, right? It goes back to everything we've been talking about so far, helplessness and despair. And I think it has an especially corrosive effect on men whose sense of masculinity and potency and identity take a terrible hit under these conditions with the economy.
Yeah, the ego definitely has a difficult time handling that.
Yes. So now, building up everything we've talked about, you know, the human being has to find some kind of control in life, right?
Right.
Okay. So how do you control such a threat to one's security? I mean, you have a president who doesn't even admit to the reality and instead spins and whitewashes it. So you begin to think, this isn't even consensual. Well, you have to restore dignity somehow. And I think here's where an unconscious assault on gay marriage comes into it, and it's being I use the word sinisterly manipulated, and brilliantly manipulated. I think that some of these Americans under siege feel like there is very little left than theirs. So much of what has defined their economic and social security, their identity, their edge, has been chiseled away. And now even their status as the heterosexual majority, with its few perks, you know what I mean,
yeah,
is under siege. And, well, this is the last straw. And areas that address one's sexual status will always be incendiary. Okay, so, you know, dealing with gay and lesbian issues can go right to the heart of that, as do the issues of the economy, you know, in terms of one's sense of potency.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then remember what I said about envy. If the structure of envy is, I'm in a deprived state, and something has been taken from me, and I can't redress the real thief because I feel powerless to affect it, then I have to locate a safer target. Now, you know, let's think about this in terms of all issues, but look at how it's at work here. I have to locate a safer target, one I can control. I can get some dignity and redress the wrong by taking away that which has been taken from me. So we resent those, and I said this earlier, that we think deprive us, but in reality have nothing to do with our lack. What you notice, if you're thinking, is that the causal links are completely false. But we have to use them as a means to secure our own status. And the problem with such an unconscious process, Stuart, and an uncritical, self-reflective mind with those kind of psychic muscles at work, is that it can be manipulated. And the electorate is ripe for such manipulation because of the state of the country. Why else would the administration, why else would organized, religious-based groups put so much focus on gay marriage at a time when we are under economic siege, when Iraq is just spinning, we're under a nuclear threat from North Korea and Iran, the color codes are changing every day in anticipation of a terrorist attack, and what do you hear about? Gay marriage, gay marriage, gay marriage, and they're using it to get people to the polls. I think it's an easy target to distract and to displace one's anger, one's outrage, and one's anxieties. And what breaks my heart, and I think of your friend Barbara, is this kind of mindset requires dehumanizing the other, who's the target of our hatred. We need to believe that their needs and their feelings and their concerns and their longings are not like ours. We then need to deprive them of their own autonomy and rights and codify it with legislation.
Mm-hmm.
So how about a constitutional amendment?
Right.
This is my theory about what's going on, and that's underneath all these stated beliefs. And what I, the reason that we want to develop these psychic muscles is because if, you know, you got to be able to look internally and find out how you're being manipulated. When you hear sound bites, when you hear talking points, right? Over and over again. How quickly does your blood begin to boil? And notice, are you really pulling back with a wider lens and taking in the bigger issues?
There is, to me, there's a lot of obvious examples historically in your theory also.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being raised Jewish as I was,
mm-hmm.
We look back in history and we see very often how the tables would constantly get turned on Jews in country after country where they go in, and when times were good, everything
yep.
was fine. If something turns bad, the population almost always, without exception, would take history up and start blaming the Jews, and pogroms would start, or anti-Semitic bashing
yep.
would increase in those countries, or they'd be forced to leave the country that they were in.
Mm-hmm.
So, we see in World War II where, Hitler demonized the Jews as the reason for the Depression and the reason why everyone was out of work and a lot of other things. I mean, it's the same thing historically.
Absolutely.
And in terms of what the Jews had to deal with historically, and I think...
And blacks, and apart, absolutely.
Blacks, and it's like people would always look for somebody, not necessarily even weaker, because sometimes it's people that they were fear was stronger and would take more away from them.
Well, you bring up a really excellent point. I mean, it's always a fail-safe maneuver from a government, in trouble.
Right.
It's kind of like, back in Rome, let's draw everybody to the Circus Maximus and watch, something that does get your blood boiled, which is the gladiator, getting eaten by the lion. Meanwhile,
or sending the Christians in there.
Right, or sending
the
Christians in.
The Christians were themselves, marked for the same type of thing.
Right, and watch Rome burn.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
So
it's important to have a mindset that can parcel out these issues, because otherwise we get tremendously manipulated.
Right. So, you also talked to me briefly during, our conversations before the show, that you saw a real sterling example of a psychologically and spiritually mature mindset
right.
that furthers human understanding rather than divided. What is that?
Yeah. As a preface to that.
Okay.
I want to refer to Barack Obama's speech at the Democratic Convention
yeah.
because it made it for one brief moment in time, I think everybody recognized their highest capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a true statesman who demonstrated, because I think that's what a statesman is supposed to do, demonstrate our highest capacities, not reach for the lowest common denominator.
Yeah, he was incredible.
This factors into an issue about, you know, a lot of people of faith think that devotion has to be uncritical. I am a believer that, and I know you are too, because it's a big theme of your show, that having a kind of critical mindset, a thinking mindset, deepens our spirituality because it allows for empathy. Empathy is what? How do you walk in another person's shoes? Jesus talked about, you know, you have to love the other person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, love isn't about what do I need in the other person. What do I get from the other person? It's how do I identify? How do I see myself in the other person? And that's where these are high psychological capacities that they're developmental.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and also looking at the outcome of our actions and being, you know, I don't know if there's a heaven and a hell. I struggle with it every day, and I'm a person of deep faith.
Mm-hmm.
And my faith is strengthened because I struggle.
Right.
Leave room for doubt, which means I have to constantly think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that I can create heaven and hell in everything that I do and think and how it affects my life and other people. And so when you vote and when you go to the polls and when you demonize other people, think about, you know, are you creating a hell for somebody else? Are you getting something at their expense, and are you even rejoicing at it?
Right. And
now,
Jesus was here to teach unconditional love.
Yeah.
And to me, which is the basis of every one of the world's major religions, then the people who are choosing
yes.
the road of hatred and judgment and disempowerment of other groups are being very unreligious.
It is a simplistic kind of religiosity. It's superficial,
mm-hmm.
right? Because deep spirituality to me is what we're talking about.
Right.
It's really digging down and parceling out and reflecting. You don't have to know yourself if you adhere to strict tenets, because if I can define myself, well, this is what I believe and that's who I am, then every single day I don't have to struggle with contradictions, right?
And in some cases this is what mom or dad taught me, and I was taught not to question. So it's not even
right.
down to the personal thing of this is what I believe, this is what I was taught to believe and not to question.
Right, and of course you want to say, well, if you were taught to use, you know, the violence in your family, do you question that?
Right.
If you were taught to be bigoted, don't you question that? I mean, the whole role of psychotherapy is that people come in appreciating and recognizing where they came from, but wanting to try to do it better.
Right.
And I think that healthy parents want their children to do it better.
Mm-hmm.
So here's the Obama speech, which really probably was the news of the Democratic Convention. Even people who, you know, would not ordinarily have watched it were talking about it and asked if they could hear it and, you know, wanted to go online and get the speech. And here's what he said that is an example of the highest state of a mature spiritual psychological mindset. And I think the two are interdependent.
Mm-hmm.
He says, alongside our famous individualism, there's another ingredient in the American saga, a belief that we are connected as one. And I'm skipping down, and he says, e pluribus unum, one out of many. Yet even one of many, one. Yet even as we speak, there are those who are preparing to divide us, spin masters and negative ad peddlers who embrace the politics of anything goes. Well, I say to them tonight, there's not a liberal America and a conservative America, there's the United States of America. There's not a black America and a white America and a Latino America and an Asian America, there's the United States of America. The pundits like to slice and dice our country into red states and blue states, red states for Republicans, blue states for Democrats, but I've got news for them. We worship an awesome God in the blue states, and we don't like federal agents poking around our libraries in the red states. And we coach Little League in the blue states, and yes, we even have gay friends in the red states. There are patriots who oppose the war in Iraq and patriots who support it. We are one people, all of us pledging allegiance to the Stars and Stripes, all of us defending the United States of America. And I will add to him, and that is our great strength. And as we approach this electorate, are we going to approach it with greater strength and unity, or are we going to cleave the American psyche and divide it and ultimately weaken us internally? Now, I'd vote for this guy any day, wouldn't you?
Yeah. I mean, I told you that when I was, you know, I think you and I have something else in common, and that is we both listened and watched the Democratic Convention gavel to gavel, thanks to C-SPAN and TiVo. I'm over the top with commentators interrupting things that are going on, and thank God to C-SPAN, because it was my choice to listen or not to listen, and I chose to listen. And in all fairness, and so nobody points fingers also, I intend to do the same gavel-to-gavel thing for the Republicans.
As do I.
And I want to know what they're thinking. I want to know who's there are inspirational Republicans out there. Just because I'm a Democrat and believe in certain things doesn't mean that I cannot value and be inspired by a Republican.
Right. That's essential. McCain is one of them.
Yeah.
You know, I'm talking about people on the, you know, who have extreme points of view.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I find somebody who stands up and says, I'm not going there.
Mm-hmm.
That is demeaning to me. That is demeaning to the people who put me in office. I'm not going to go with something that is politically expedient, which violates my core principles, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is my hero.
Yeah.
And I don't care what their political persuasion is. I don't care what their religious affiliation is. I'm looking for, as you said at the beginning of the show, a spiritually and psychologically balanced mindset.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly we have we're in a very challenging time of history that requires these kinds of skills. You know, when you have a president who doesn't take in the information from the State Department and apply it, and now, you know, about what would happen as a result of going in there, right? Because they predicted all of what's happening.
Right.
And then you have, you know, somebody who doesn't turn to his own father, you know, who went into Iraq in a very intelligent way, and you know, you can argue.
Right.
But who says, and I wrote down the... you know, the quote here that he says that, you know, he turned to, quote, a higher father. And Bob Woodward in Plan of Attack says, you know, many wonder, certainly something I believe, that his uncritical devotion closes him off from conflicting points of view to, quote, bypass the mind and go straight to the bloodstream. Well, I don't want anybody who has my country and my family's needs, you know, in his hand, to bypass any kind of critical, contradictory thought.
Mm-hmm.
I don't find a yes or no answer to be the sign of great leadership. I want to know that somebody has really struggled with the ambiguities and the nuances before a decision is made. Because you and I both know that, you know, what is in the bloodstream can pull us into all kinds of directions that are not necessarily thoughtful.
Well, the same is true as therapists of what we deal with individuals. In an individual session, everything you're talking about is the same thing that goes on in our own personal inner struggles as we're dealing with things. I mean, I have a client who's actually French who is in a relationship for many years with another man and is still so tortured and so struggled because of what the Catholic Church taught him in France growing up about homosexuality and a lot of other stuff, and yet he's very happy and knows that there's a lot of love in the context of this relationship, but he keeps turning it over to the higher powers that be, planetary higher powers, meaning
mm-hmm.
the Pope, the Church itself, what his parents taught him to think, and you could see the internal conflict of when what's coming out of his mouth is what those teachings were about, and when his heart is speaking out through
yes.
his mouth.
And it takes great courage, doesn't it, Stuart?
Yeah, yeah. And this is the first time he's been in therapy and the first time he's actually dealt with this, but the struggle is so evident. And I think it's that same struggle that you're challenging our listeners and people all over this country, and in that sense all over the world, to step back and say, what do I really feel? Do I really feel that killing somebody from another country is the higher thought here just because they're from another country? I mean, there's an athlete, I forgot what country he's from, but his country does not recognize Israel. And the first athlete he was paired off in the wrestling competition is an Israeli. And last night I heard he was contemplating dropping out of the Olympics because by competing against this Israeli, he's acknowledging that country exists. I mean, the whole point of the Olympics is to transcend that sort of thinking and to see this as another athlete against an athlete and going for that. I mean, that to me is the essence of the struggles people are still doing internally.
Right. Well, it's this kind of compartmentalization that we're talking about. And what it ultimately does is it weakens. It weakens us, doesn't it? Because it takes a tremendous amount of effort to try to maintain a point of view by disregarding every other contradictory piece of information, even when it's in your face or it's your neighbor or it's your child who, you know, demonstrates, well, wait a minute, somebody different may not be dangerous because I actually know this person.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know the amount of psychic energy that goes into maintaining compartmentalization.
Right.
It takes a lot less energy, although it takes...
courage.
It takes courage to integrate.
Right.
And then to be able to, you know, I mean, I'll sit among my group, and they tend to be more liberal than conservative, and the courage is to sit there and go, hey, wait a minute, think that one out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, even that's too black and white right there.
Right.
And certainly to sit, you know, among any kind of extremist group, it takes a lot of courage to bring your humanity to it when you've done your own work, and say, well, I see that point of view, but I don't agree here, and here's why. And what we often get, instead of a mature discourse, is we get name-calling. I mean, we see it egregiously.
Right.
You know, I mean, what was Schwarzenegger's comment? Now, I know he was doing his thing, but, you know, like girly men. I mean,
right.
And talk about, you know, let's go for the incendiary quality of sexuality, right?
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I, as a therapist, am urging, which is that kind of bravery, that kind of soul-searching, that kind of quiet kind of spirituality where you think about what is being said and you kind of parcel it out and then struggle with it. I think that is the highest level of spirituality and religiosity.
I think, Constance, that that is the best statement that we can close on, because there's nothing I could say to improve on that. We're coming to the end of our hour, and I want to actually start by thanking you for taking the time, and I know that you were still formulating a lot of this as we were coming up to today, and the effort you put into it was really clear.
Thank you, Stuart.
And I thank you for your wisdom and your insight and your courage to speak your own heart.
And to you, back to you.
Thank you. And I invite my listeners, if you want to get in touch with Connie, you can do it via my website, tellthetruthfaster.com. This show, if you want to hear it again or want to get a friend to listen to it, will be archived within the next week. And you can listen to the last 3 years of my show, every show that I've done, with the exception of two where they seem to have been lost, are up there for you to listen on any topic. And I invite your comments, I invite your questions, And I invite you to listen again next week. This is Stuart Altshuler and Tell the Truth Faster on KXAM in Phoenix. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend and enjoy the Olympics.